It was nice and calm and peaceful and dry. No rain at all this morning. We did have some just a little sprinkle in the Dharamsala after lunch. But that was me with the holy water.
Keep the meeting open for a while, Chris, but you can start if you want.
Oh, okay. Well, good evening,
Ajahn. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening,
Ajahn. Nice to see you all.
And welcome.
Yeah.
Ajahn, tonight I'll be your MC for the evening. I'm Chris from Osaka in Japan, and... You have a special place in my heart, Ajahn, because I came across your teachings on podcasts, and suddenly Thailand and Laos, where I spend a lot of my time, both made sense to me. So, Ajahn, thank you for that, and welcome to this evening.
Very good. That's welcome very nice. Excellent. So we're almost ready to start, but as many people know, that I usually start when I'm on with a joke. So, why won't sharks bite lawyers? We have lots of shark attacks here in Australia, but the shark never bites a lawyer.
Professional courtesy.
Exactly, you were at my talk last week, yes. Professional courtesy, they're in the same business. If there's any lawyers here, please don't sue me.
Well, Ajahn, if everyone's ready, shall we? Would you like to lead us in chanting the Metta Sutra, Ajahn?
Yes, I certainly can do that for you.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
So, okay, well, are you ready?
Let's see if I can screen share it. I might even be able to do that myself this evening. Oh, I've got mine ready to go, so it's a competition, is it?
Okay. So, are you ready? Okay, here we go.
Oh, yes.
A one. Yep. It's gone again. A one.
Mute us first. Please mute us. Ajahn needs to unmute.
Okay, here we go. Can we see it? Okay. I can't see anything. Can you see anything? No, the Metta Sutra's gone. Here we go. Hey, okay. Here we go. A one, a two, a one, two, three, four. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. May all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. Could you all hear that? Good, excellent. So, it's something which I'd learnt as a young monk, was whatever you do, give it everything you've got. In other words, put lots of energy into every moment of your life. And you find if you do it the right way, you don't get tired, but you get uplifted and inspired. And that's much better than if you do that chant, the metta chant, and you start chanting, this is what should be done by one. That is just so dispiriting. And so when you give it some oomph, some energy, you do actually find that you enjoy it more, you've got more power, and that power, that energy lasts afterwards. So little by little, we put more into what we're doing, and that means that when it's time to talk, we talk. When it's time to meditate, we really know how to meditate. When it's time to sleep, we really know how to sleep. Little by little, we put lots of whatever we have into what we're doing, and we find we are fitter, healthier, and more energy in life. Little things like, last time I saw you was just before the rains retreat. This last rains retreat is now over, and I had my 70th birthday. And for some people, you get old, and people get very depressed or tired. But I always like to see something positive in whatever happens. And that is that the more birthdays you have, the longer you live. That is obvious. But it's a nice way of looking at things. And making a nice way of looking at things makes you just more energized, more alert, and it makes it much more fun. And the fun and the joy is also a cause of good meditation, and it's also a result of good meditation. It's not just learning how to be peaceful. It's learning how to turn that peace into something powerful and still and immense. It's one of the things which I've often taught you when I went over to Melbourne, to Armidale, is that there are many different levels of mindfulness. There's the ordinary mindfulness, which, you know, even like a drunken person has some mindfulness, enough to find their way home after going to the bar or pub at night. they can just sort of find their way home. But the real mindfulness is much more powerful awareness. You see more. And of course, the really what I used to call superpower mindfulness, that's when you're so aware, you can see so much more deeply into things. And that superpower awareness is no result of meditation. It's a great thing to experience, really fun, and you can do many, many benefits with it. Even like simple things, like when I was, I mentioned this last week to somebody, that when I was invited to South Korea, to Daejeon, to give the keynote address at the World Computer Conference, I think it was in 2019. Amazing! The only reason I can do this Zoom talk with you is because Venerable Sagar, who sits just behind the screen there, sets it all up for me. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't know what to do. I am not computer savvy. But nevertheless, I can still give a keynote address to all these people who really were computer savvy. And one of the people I remember was the head of the cybersecurity for the European Union at the time, the boss of it. And a lot of people asked, what am I doing there? And I was saying that because there's some things which you can learn in meditation which can enhance so many skills in your life. And one of those is learning how to be really peaceful, very still, not just to overcome stress, that's one byproduct, but also so you can see more deeply into things. You can actually take something and really investigate it, not with force, but see very deeply into it, and you can get innovations that way. And I mentioned this Brian Josephson, who was the only Welshman who's won the Nobel Prize in Physics. And he got his great breakthrough in quantum tunneling, if you want to know, after he came out of a meditation. And he always recommends that that is a wonderful way to innovate to the point of getting even Nobel Prizes. So little by little, we learn how to meditate, and we learn how to increase the energies of our mind. Not the energies so much of our body, but the energies of our mind. And how we do that, instead of the mind leaking energy into the body, with having to see and to do and to struggle, all of those wastages are just let go of as we learn how to focus inside. And as you focus inside, inside this moment, and it's those simple things like inside the silence, these beautiful pauses between things. You know, to get people to understand what the silence is, the emptiness, the peace, so often you ask, you know, whoever you are sitting right now, you look in your room, why is it that we always notice the material things in this room where you're sitting? I know that Chris has got this beautiful landscape in the back, but I know enough about computers. He's not sitting outside in the mountains of Japan. That's just the screen shot behind him. But wherever you're standing, there's more emptiness in your room than there are things. But we don't notice that. We just notice the stuff in our houses, in our rooms, the people, not what's between the people. And it's a different way of looking. And we deliberately decide, just for some interesting and fun, not to look at the words, but the space between the words. Not to try and define things, but actually to leave them undefined. So our mind is more peaceful. And we see things like emptiness in a room is always far greater than the things in a room. Little things like that mean that when you start to even listen, the spaces between sounds are always much greater. The spaces between feelings in your body, there are spaces there, always much greater. And little by little, we find even the spaces between thoughts and names are much greater. So little by little, you find the secret of how to find some space in your life. In that space, it's still and peaceful. And that peace, that's where you can find some energy. It's just like, you know, charging up your laptop or charging up your mobile phone. It's being used at the time, you waste so much energy. Just leave it alone, it builds up in energy. I love feeling that energy which comes when you just don't do anything, when you're just aware, mindful, in this moment, and let things grow. Because that gives you a huge amount of clarity and energy and happiness. It's a simple thing, but many times people, they take coffee or tea because that does give you some cheap energy. When you meditate, you get much more energy. And that energy which you get from meditation is much more powerful, much more still. And it sees deeply into things. And that's the sort of energy which you'd like to develop through meditation. That's great for your health, both physical health and emotional health. And it's fantastic just what you see and how deeply you see into it. And just all the great insights which come up. Simple things. Okay, please excuse me again, but this, I always bring up this simile at the time, but the reason I'm bringing it up now, there's one of the people who follow us online all the time. He lives over in Italy, and I think he works at CERN, that big atom, fundamental particle collider. And he's a bit of a philosopher as well as a scientist, as well as a meditating Buddhist. But he was also saying that one of the things which I said solved one of the deep philosophical problems which he had, you know, was the nature of what beauty is. Because what beauty is, that attracts us. What is beauty? Many years ago, went over to to India to see the site where the Buddha lived. And because it was India, and because there was many people there, part of the tour was to go and see the Taj Mahal. And then I was with another lady here from Perth, and just standing next to her, and she said, "This is a bit over the top, isn't it?" She couldn't see the beauty in it, and neither could I. I was trying to find out where that beauty was. What is beauty? And little by little, the story which I told, which is a gross story, but I think you all know what's coming now, is just doing a retreat, a meditation retreat, here in Perth, at Jhana Grove. And carrying some really great meditation, because, you know, I meditate as well when I teach meditation. And also that, like anybody, you had to go to the toilet. And when I went to the toilet, I had to do what we call in Australia, number two. I think you all know what that number two is. And when I went and did a number two, I made a big mistake. Before flushing, I looked in the toilet bowl. When I looked in the toilet bowl, honestly, no exaggeration. People think I just make up these stories, but this is no exaggeration. It's not a joke, it's real. What I saw in the toilet bowl was the most attractive, beautiful piece of feces that I've ever seen in my life. Just the shape of it was like some sculpture made by Rodin. And the distribution of colour wasn't just all brown, it was just many shades of brown. And that was, like, I don't know how they could actually put something together where the shades of dark brown and lighter brown, they sort of tended to balance one another. And just, there was a tiny bit of phlegm on it, which was like diamond. It was shimmering in the toilet bowl. And the scent of it, the aroma, which is so deep and real and earthy, not like something you have from the incense. This was like real stuff, and really deep and powerful. And honestly, I was just in that toilet in Jhana Grove, just going, wow, 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 this is amazing. And afterwards, you know, I've got to complete the story. I did really think it was touch and go whether I should take it out and show my friends. It was a thing of beauty. But then I'd been very well trained, not just in hygiene, but also trained in letting go. And so I did push the little button on the top to flush it all away. I let it go. And the weird thing was that that description, which was as accurate as I can portray it, I don't add things, was what showed that PhD researcher in fundamental particle physics, he said it showed him what beauty was. He answered that question and sort of answered it. You can see something even as, you know, what most people think was just to be thrown away and just expelled by pressing the flush button. It showed him just the nature of this mind, of how we can create beauty with almost anything. A real beauty which satisfies us is originating from the way we look at things. If we have energy, so many things look beautiful. And what that also means is that some people ask me in meditation, how can you just sit there watching a breath, you know, for such a long time? The breath is just goes in, goes out. That's not interesting. You're breathing it all the time. Why is it beautiful? Why can you just sit and watch it for hours sometimes? And the reason is because you get to a certain stage of mindfulness where the mind is energized, and what you see so much more into just, you know, the breath going in and the breath going out. And it becomes delightful. You know, it's weird sometimes to try and explain meditation to people who, you know, haven't had experiences or haven't sort of really understood how the Buddha was teaching meditation, or someone like Ajahn Chah would teach meditation. But it's a delightful, enjoyable, wonderful thing to do. So much so that sometimes people think you're attached to meditation. And in one of those teachings of the Buddha, Pasadika Sutta, you put your hand up and say, yes, I'm attached to meditation. The Buddha said, tell everybody that. Because anyone who's attached to meditation, what it really means, you're attached to letting go. You're not really attached at all, it just seems that way. The more you let go, the more you renounce, the more you love stillness, the more peaceful you are, and the more still you are. And you can meditate for hours, simply because you have that energy of stillness. Now, you think that might be a bit too much for you. I'm not sure, I haven't seen you for a while, but nevertheless, I know quite a few of you in here. And sometimes it just happens. You're meditating there and you follow the ordinary procedures. And sometimes everything comes together, all the conditions seem to work, and you get very peaceful and very still. And you feel it. What do I mean by peace and stillness? You can explain it for many, many words, but then in the end, it's how you feel. Well, you know, meditation is not an intellectual journey, it's an emotional journey. You feel your way into meditation. And sometimes they give me some instructions, and in a few minutes I will. And that is the guided meditations. And those guided meditations are great because it means you don't need to think and worry about anything. It's like you're sitting next to me and I'm your driving instructor in a car, so you don't have to worry about anything. And because you feel safe and because you're given good instructions, your mind becomes peaceful. And when it becomes peaceful, instead of you thinking, oh, what should I do next? I'm right next to you as it was, and I'll tell you what to do next. And those instructions take you even more deep. And you feel confident and safe. There's many parts of meditation where if people don't know really what they're doing, haven't been well instructed, you feel a bit uncomfortable, like you're going into a new place you've never been to before. And you feel, wow, what's happening? This is dangerous. It's not dangerous at all, it's just you're unfamiliar with the territory. But little by little, you go a little bit deeper, and you find it's just so safe, so beneficial and so enjoyable. And little by little, as you go deeper and deeper, you come out afterwards And you find you just, oh, this was really good. And that goodness, that afterglow of meditation, lasts for a long time. And you see all the benefits of it. Not just you, but the people you live with see it as well. And that's always wonderful when you come out of meditation and your husband or your wife or your kids say, wow, you know, what have you done, Mum? And you see, feel so much more peaceful. Or just an ordinary story, just in the Armadale group many years ago, this lady came up and she said, I never felt like coming to the group this evening, on a Tuesday evening when we used to have it in Armadale Hospital. I never felt like coming this evening. I was tired after coming home from work. So, well, why did you come? She said, my kids sent me here. There were two children. They said, Mummy, are you going to meditation tonight? No, I don't feel like it. I'm tired. Mummy, you must go to meditation tonight. Oh, Mummy, go to meditation. Why? Because you are a much nicer mummy when you come back from meditation. Other people can see it really easily. Sometimes we don't see it ourselves because we're too close to ourselves. But other people can see it in the long term. You can really notice the effects. Energized, peaceful. It's a sort of energy that, you know, if it gets very deep, you know, then you just want to keep on meditating. But often it's quiet enough and peaceful enough. When you go to bed yourself, you can sleep very peacefully. You know how to do it. You know how to let go of all the worries and concerns of your life. No past, no future. And you don't think. You just lay back in the bed and allow the mind to go off into sleep. It's a beautiful thing which we're doing. And so many benefits. And I think you've known me for a long time. You've seen many of those benefits. And hopefully you'll see more. But right now, looking at the clock, the time, it's getting close to the time we start the meditation. This is just the introductory part of it. And after the introductory part of it, we'll be open for all sorts of questions which you have. But this is just how we begin. And never, never underestimate yourself. In all the time I've been teaching meditation, that sometimes people just get in there and they just get so peaceful. So it surprises themselves. And we always measure ourselves negatively. You're not good enough. Oh, I can't do this. This is really deep stuff. No. Give it a try. And sometimes we get surprise ourselves. And sometimes we get very peaceful. We don't need to put any effort in. Don't need to get afraid. Let it carry on. And you find just a way to get even more still is to watch that stillness and don't disturb it. Don't say anything in your head. You remember whatever you experienced so well that afterwards when you come out, that's when you start thinking, oh, what was that? How was that? Why was that? But while it's happening, enjoy it to the max. It's always beneficial. Never seen any problems. In all those years I've been teaching meditation, it's always positive, positive, positive in every which way. So anyway, it's now time to get yourself ready to meditate and see what happens. So if you'd like to get yourselves in your meditation position, you can get out first of all. And okay, I'm going to do this. Yeah, why not? Because teach by example. To get up and stretch. Have a good stretch. Oh, you can see my belly now. Maybe that was not such a good idea. Have a good stretch. And when you've had a good stretch, loosen some of those muscles. It's a time to meditate. And again, I will just lead the meditation, guided meditation. And once the guided meditation, well, usually I go for 15 or 20 minutes guidance, and then I let you free. Just see where you go after I become quiet. And enjoy it to the max, and don't ever be afraid. Meditation is one of the most harmless and helpful activities you can possibly do. So here we go. So you close your eyes. I usually meditate on the floor, but today I'm meditating on a chair. One of the things I always do when meditating on a chair is I always start with my feet in a stupid position. I wasn't paying much attention to them. So now I'm going to move my feet so that I like it flat on the floor. It's a nice carpet, believe it or not, in this room. And I feel the carpet with my feet. I love doing things like that because the carpet is soft. As I feel the carpet with my bare feet, it feels so comfortable. And I'm not afraid of enjoying that contact between the skin of my feet and the soft carpet. What it does, it means I can stay there just with that little body awareness of feet on carpet. I better keep going because I could probably spend the whole half an hour with that feeling. It feels nice. I'm relaxed. I did meditation this afternoon. And then I go to my whole feet on both sides. And I love being kind to myself. Being kind to myself is first of all being kind to my body. Feet, how are you? I treat them as if they were individual beings, not belonging to me, but my friends. Do you need to be adjusted? Anything I can do to make you more comfortable? You know, when I listen, I get answers. My feet say, they're connected to my legs, so I just need to move my legs a bit further out. That makes it feel better. Well, it works. Then when my feet are comfortable, go to my ankles, make sure they're comfortable. Even though there's no problems in my ankles, I still ask them. It just shows you care. You may have kids living with you, and even just ask them, and even if you know they're okay, you know, little son, are you okay today? It means that you do think about them, care about them. Now I'm just caring for my own body, my ankles. And then I go up to my calves. The calves are really peaceful. No aches, no pains. But nevertheless, I check, are you comfortable like that? Do you need to be adjusted? And it's like I hear the answer, no, I'm fine. If you need to adjust to your calves, please do so. And it's not just to get the most comfortable position, it's also an exercise in establishing mindfulness together with kindness, which is the key to deep meditation. It's not effort, it's not wanting. It's just mindfulness and kindness, setting that up and letting it do the job. And then I look at my knees, make sure my knees are comfy. Even though I sit in meditation cross-legged for so long, my knees are in pretty good condition. Go to my thighs. I can feel like a tingle on the surface of the skin on my thighs. You're aware enough to feel all sensations there. But it's not unpleasant, it's actually very, very pleasant. My legs are at ease. And I know just keeping them like this, they'll get more at ease over the half an hour. And I go to my butt. And the butt is under pressure because I've got the whole weight of my upper body on these two muscles of my buttocks. And I make sure that they are as comfortable as I possibly can. This is a time I often fidget to make sure that both of those muscles are as comfortable as I possibly can get them. Yeah, it worked. And I go to my back. I feel my back. Ask it. Back. How are you? Got a little bit of an ache in the right side of my back. Just stretch it a little bit. It feels better. A lot of the time, I don't know whether it's the stretch I just did made it better or just the fact I cared for it. The power of care to heal tightness in your body and thereby to get past pain, I think it's amazing. I've done it so many times, and how it works, not totally sure, but it works, that's good enough. And I go to the front of my body with all the digestive tracts there and the organs, important organs like kidneys and livers and and spleens and what else is that in there? The lungs and the stomach and the heart. And I just actually do a quick scan of my own body. Just like if you've ever been in a scan in a hospital. But this is actually your own mindfulness scanning the insides of your torso. And as I scan those, I don't try and discover what's there. I'm just on the lookout for anything which is unusual or uncomfortable, any tightness, any stress, anything which is unusual. If I find that, I just stay there. My mindfulness focuses in and I give it some relaxation, the own loving kindness. Irradiate it with warm feelings of I care for you. And little by little you find any tightness, tension, ache, pain in your torso. If you find it gets more tight, more painful, it means you're going in the wrong direction. Try something else. Try letting it be. Try caring. Opening the door of your heart to that part of your body and how it feels. Allowing it, not being afraid. Releasing the tension. Because I've done this such a long time, so many years. It's so easy to take a part of my body and relax it to the max. And it feels so much better. And then after going through my torso, I spend a little time on the shoulders because they can get tight and ache during the meditation. So I make sure they're all loose. Nothing is being held tight. I feel that. If it is tight, I know how to relax it. Sometimes it's trial and error till you get to understand how to relax parts of your own body. It's well worth taking the time to learn that. And I get to my throat. Hay fever season right now. So my throat is itchy. Not that bad. And I just welcome it. Don't fight it. Be at peace with it. And the whole thing just calms down immensely. I go to the front of my face. My bridge of my nose is inflamed because of the hay fever. You may have tension of your headache or over your forehead, around your eyes. How is your face now? If you see a tightness there which is uncomfortable, relax it. I'm relaxing the bridge of, well, it's already relaxed myself. The bridge of my nose feels really good now. You learn the mindfulness and kindness working together. It just eases so much tightness and tension, which is either caused by pain or reinforces the pain and sickness. It all eases off. And at the end of this little exercise, I look at my whole body. From the toes to the tip of the head, the whole thing, and relax it to the max. And I do this carefully, seriously. I see any part of my body which is tight, I'll adjust it. Until it feels like it's been massaged, feels like it's been in a hot bath, feel like it's been laying on a recliner all day and you're so comfy. I'm not afraid of the pleasure of comfort, because it means my body is at ease and I can let it go and go to the mind. When I go to the mind, I ask myself, how peaceful am I? Or how agitated? How peaceful? Actually, I don't do this myself, but I ask others to do it. 1 to 10 gives you more of an idea of how peaceful you are. Gives you a better ability to know the difference between being really peaceful, moderately peaceful and agitated. All you're doing is looking at the mind. That's where those qualities exist. Next thing is, how can you be more peaceful? Little things like living in the present moment more, especially during meditation. Everything which you've done in the past, that is a fantasy. You can't rely upon your memories of the past. So many people put themselves in the prisons of the past, where the door's open, you can just walk out. I mean that. You'll be in this present moment. Fear of the past. You learn so much more from the present, from now, than you'll ever learn from the past. The present is the school of wisdom and kindness. And if you're worried about the future, now is where your future is being made. This is where you make future, right now. This is the only time you can do anything about the future, right now. So be kind to this moment. You find the past and the future, because they're not so important as you once thought. They're not so reliable. You can give more value, more importance to the present moment. And here you find some peace, some silence. When you are peaceful, just notice how enjoyable that is. It's like you're free. I could be in the prison of burdens and duties and memories as well. They create the bars of the prison in which we mostly live. Now you're free. You're in this moment. If we can stop thinking, notice the spaces. It's getting more and more peaceful. And you're experiencing these things. The experience is somewhat more powerful than anything I can say. If you want to watch the breath, it usually comes up by itself. And it's pleasant, it's enjoyable. And I notice that joy. Got nothing to do in these minutes. So just watch a breath, go quietly in. And watch it go quietly out all by itself. I don't do a thing. Now I will be quiet. When it gets close to the end of the meditation, I'll ring the bell. I'll give warning first. So, may you enjoy this meditation to the max. is getting close to the end of this short meditation. How do you feel physically, emotionally? What worked? What made you more peaceful, more free, more still? It's usually the end of the meditation is where you learn, gain insights, not in the middle. You learn to value just being in the present, being still, not saying anything, and trusting that when you rest, the mindfulness increases, and you feel free, energized. I'm now going to ring the gong 3 times. Signal to come out from the mind back into the body. And if you can, please smile at the end of a meditation. It's always lovely to take the happiness from inside, outside. Okay. Now, having finished the meditation part, we usually have the questions or some subject you'd like me to talk about. So, Chris, you're supposed to be the MC.
Okay. Adam, thank you very much for that. That was most beautiful. Can you give us more advice on looking for the spaces and finding the stillness in the spaces?
Yeah, okay. With looking for the spaces, is we've been taught, brainwashed if you like, to always look for things, look for objects, people. But the spaces between people are something much more different. And sometimes those of you who want relationship studies, the relationship is what happens between two people. It's not what's in him or her or whatever, it's what's between. And the same with, you know, the important stuff of life. It's just, you know, how we react to things. That reaction is between you and that thing you're reacting with. And that's the place, that space there. We make that very peaceful and very kind and warm. It's amazing, just it changes the way we look at things. There's nothing in this world which we can't make some benefit out of. And that's why there's, I mentioned this point to the monks in the Rains Retreat, there's no such thing as a bad meditation. All meditations are great because the ones which we think are not that peaceful, we learn so much. We grow. And little by little we grow understanding our mind and our body, understanding things like time, understanding things like space. And learning is pretty great for someone like myself. You can go out into the forest, especially when there's no one else around. And it's peaceful, There's nothing there. And you're not afraid of nothing there. In fact, the less you have, the more safe you feel. So many things in our life we can get so much joy out of, where other people think it's boring. They don't have anything to watch. You know that emptiness, spaces, these are things we can't control. We can control things. We can't really control between things. That's one of the wonderful things, that these are the times when you value what's between things. And you grow spiritually, enormously. A little, you notice, I haven't mentioned this, talked about this for years, but it's such a nice little insight. The in-between times of your life, that's actually the majority of the years which you live, you're in-between things. You've left home, you haven't arrived at work yet. You know, you started something, haven't finished it yet. You're in between. In a few, half an hour, I'll leave this little office and walk to my hut. I'll be in between again. Haven't arrived at my destination, but left the origin. So those in-between moments of life, that's where most of the action is, but we waste those in-between times as we think of where we're going to get to and how we're going to get there, whether it's going to be late or early. And even in the mind, when you meditate, sometimes you've closed your eyes, you've begun the meditation, we haven't finished yet. We're concerned about what's happening in between. Don't be concerned at all. Just be in between. I like that in between concept. You might call it the middle way. But it's not really the middle way of the Buddha, but it's just a lovely way of meditating. Be comfortable being in between and don't always want to get to your destination. You've already arrived. You're here. And that's a different way of looking. Same spaces between things. Value them. Whatever you value, the mind will go towards, and it's a great little vein of gold, you know, in the mine, if you like, of meditation. Make any sense?
Yeah, it does, Ajahn. Thank you very much. We have a question for you too in the chat, Ajahn. Would you like
okay.
to read it for you?
I'll read it if you like. Hello, Ajahn. Anon here. 2 years passed since we met at interview during Jhana Grove in January 2020, which was very important to me. Sorry to have to ask this here, but I've been wondering these days, one, does one have to completely let go of sense of self in second, third or fourth jhana to be a non-returner? You don't. The jhanas, first of all, answer that first question. The jhanas themselves is a very deep meditation where you get incredibly still. So much still that you have one thing in front of your mind for just, no, actually with that thing, for the whole period of that meditation. And because of that, you cannot get any insight, understanding within those jhanas. Those jhanas are just where you're so still, you're building up your energy. And once you get that energy very, very strong, and eventually you come out of those jhanas, afterwards, that's where you get the powerful insights. And similarly, which, it's very hard to find similes, but the simile which I often give is a simile of the tadpole and the frog. Tadpole and the frog, is simile goes like this. The tadpole can't understand water. All the time was in water, lived in water, grown up in water, will never understand water, no more than a fish can. But one day the tadpole is different than the fish, because the tadpole grows legs and arms, becomes a frog, and a frog one day jumps out of the water. When it jumps out of the water, it's a different experience. Things which have always been there are no longer there. And in the jhanas, it's like your body, the five senses are gone. In the second jhana, the will has gone. I mean, it's just not there anymore. It's not that you don't exercise it. It's not there. And the thing is, you don't know those things. You can't know those things within the jhana. You're just so still and peaceful. You come out afterwards, wow, what the heck was that? And when you come out afterwards and you see those things, that is where you get the insights from. Huge, very clear memory. And also that now's the time you figure out what that means. So those are the times when great insights come, not within the jhanas, but afterwards. But you do need those things. Okay. Can someone become a non-returner without being able to let go of the sense of self in the deeper jhanas? And if so, how can someone know whether they reached that stage while still having remained a sense of self? Thank you so much, Ajahn. So that, how does one, if one, does one need to, you don't let go of the sense of self so much in the jhanas, it's just afterwards. You understand what these things we thought we were, we're not. Once we understand what the will is, what consciousness is, we spent so long time thinking these things are me and mine, and now we learn how to let these things go. It's a very deep question. I hope I'm not sort of going too deep for you all here, because I don't usually talk about these states, and unless, you know, even during retreats, don't really mention these states too much. But this is actually powerful stuff, but it's where the power of those deep meditations give you so much energy. It's not you just know what beautiful is, how we create these things, and how the energy of the mind makes things beautiful. But also we learn just, you know, who we are, or rather who we thought we were, and allow these things to totally vanish.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Okay.
That really is a very, very deep, very interesting answer. We have another message in the chat from Nathan.
Okay.
Would you like to read it?
Ajahn, do you think there are any links between Stoic philosophy from ancient Greece and Buddhism? Again, I'm not a philosopher, and my sort of understanding is linked to meditation and Buddhism. But there could be, because I know a good old Pythagoras, you know, Pythagoras' theorem. Somewhere in his teaching, I remember reading this years ago, that he said he got all his philosophy from the Indians. And there was, you know, some contact between what we call Greek philosophy and Indian philosophy. And it might be quite likely that the Stoics had an influence from the Indians. And that link, quite frankly, is because of like Western conceit that we started things. We don't acknowledge the great stuff which actually came in from India at that time. There's lots of people coming and going. So there was that connection there between the Indians and the Greek and Egyptian eras. But you never can be sure. It's in the past. Yeah.
Does anybody else have any questions, particularly about maybe their own meditation practice for Ajahn?
It's something which I'm always interested in. Have you got any questions yet? Yeah. I'm just going to ask you. Yeah, go on.
Should I raise my hand?
Yes.
Hello, so my apologies, I missed the meditation because of the time change here, I forgot. So I do apologize for that. But I do have a question, and there is this phrase in this, about path, fruition, and deathless. And it seems, okay, clear cut, path, fruition, deathless, but can you piece that out a little bit? Because I think path and fruition interplays, and then of course there's deathless, so there's more to it, yes, than just path, fruition, deathless. Thank you.
Of course there is. And monks spend a lot of time arguing about these things. But instead of arguing, the path and fruition is just in the stages of enlightenment. It is especially important for like stream winning, where you actually see that there's nothing in here. It's totally empty, subject to cessation, etc. That is a tough one, because there's many monks, they just argue, is it really necessary you have to have a deep meditation to become a stream winner? And most monks agree, yes, you do, but there's always a but here. In the time of the Buddha, there are these people, and they were trying to assassinate the Buddha. You know, it's sometimes people think, oh, Buddhism is nice and peaceful and harmonious. They've got some really serious stories in there. And one of those serious stories that somebody wanted to take over Buddhism, they weren't allowed, and so they tried to kill the Buddha. And the way they did it was they employed an assassin to sneak up on the Buddha and kill him with a sword. And then, to make sure that they left no traces, two other assassins were told to kill that first assassin, four to kill the two, eight to kill the four, 16 to kill the eight, and 32 to kill the 16. It's a neat idea, you might say, but a rotten thing to do. But anyway, so have you ever noticed that some people are just so kind and so pure and just, oh, I can't do it. That's the first assassin, just no way could he kill the Buddha. Not the Buddha was strong and defended himself, he just had loving kindness. There's no way you can harm someone like that. And so anyway, that first assassin said, look, I came here to kill you, but I just can't do it. And then the Buddha taught him some teachings, and he's supposed to become a stream winner, the first stage of enlightenment. And then the two were looking for the one, and the Buddha said, don't go this way, they're looking for you, they're going to kill you, you go the other way. And the two were looking for the first one, and the Buddha saw them and told them, they become stream winners. A whole lot became stream winners. And that's really sort of unlikely. These were assassins, you know, hard nuts. And that the Buddha could actually touch something deep inside of them, which was so pure and so wonderful, was amazing. But what it really means is these were people, they say, on the path to being a stream winner. On the path. And because they had so much faith in meeting this wonderful Buddha, they had swords in their hand, wanted to kill the Buddha, but they just couldn't do it. That's a pretty impressive thing to experience. And what that did gave them so much confidence and faith. They decided they can't be assassins anymore, but learn how to practice Dhamma, start keeping precepts, start being generous, start learning how to meditate. That's where the practice started. And of course, they say that once you enter the stream, the path, you have to reach the fruition before you die, or at your death, one of the two. And so that's why they call them stream winners. So that path of fruition was very easy to understand. Sometimes you get so much confidence and faith in the teaching, you say, I'm going to follow this. So many people get faith in Buddhism, and sometimes they say they go away, they don't really want to be a monk or be a nun, but in the end, they actually get drawn back as best they can. So that's for the first, and seeing the Dhamma, the simile was that like a person who is in the ocean, shipwrecked, and they look around and they can actually see the shore. They see safety. And that's considered to be a great simile by the Buddha of one who is a stream winner. They've seen safety. One on the path is they're just being told, no, just have a look over there, and they have faith to look over there. But one who's actually seen safety, they're called a stream winner. The next one is they're swimming towards the shore, and that's on the path. And the next one is they're so close to the shore they don't need to swim anymore, they can stand up, they feel something solid under their feet. They're just wading through the surf. The last one, the arahat, they're on dry land, they're safe, sitting under a coconut tree, just having a nice drink of coconut, just they've done a very hard journey. And that's something which brings the idea of enlightenment into something which is easy to understand. And the deathless, we always argue about that one, because it doesn't really mean deathless. It means the absence of death. It's not a state. Because no, people don't like this, but it's very obvious in the suttas where the Buddha said it. This is when not just your body, but even your mind, consciousness, has done its job. It finishes, disappears. It wasn't really anything there to begin with. Just this process, one thing causing another, and now it's ended. For many people, they rebel against that because they've got a very strong sense of being. And the idea of not being, that terrifies them. Okay, I did hear someone say, ooh.
I did, Ajahn.
Yeah.
I took my breath away there for a moment. Wow, that was very beautiful. Upeksha also has a question for you in the chat, Ajahn.
Okay.
Dear Ajahn.
Oh, yeah, we see. Dear Ajahn, after a certain point, do we feel the breath in your conscious or your forehead? Does that happen? It can happen. All sorts of incredible things happen when you're meditating. But after a while, it's best to let the breath disappear by itself. Don't hold on to anything. The more and more peaceful you get, the less you need your breath. The breath is just important for your metabolism. But after a while, the metabolism gets so peaceful, you hardly need any breath at all. But as far as you're concerned, what you're aware of is the body can mess around when you first get very, very still. And the simile which I've used often is it's like, you know, the first time, you know, you leave home and you go to some university, you go overseas for a job. Imagine your kids, the first time they leave home and they go to university somewhere, they play around, they're free, mum and dad aren't around. So they mess around and enjoy themselves. This is like your mind, when it gets a little bit free from the body, it can start to create all sorts of interesting, wonderful, weird stuff. But it's nothing to be afraid of, because if your breath in, we feel the breath in our consciousness on your forehead, yeah, you can do that if you wish. You can mess around. I don't know, my big toe, I remember just doing it on my big toe years ago. I mean, imagine my big toe breathing in, breathing out. It's totally impossible scientifically, but that's what it feels like. It happens by itself. And all that's really happening is just the mindfulness is getting so strong. It's enjoying itself, playing around a little bit, having fun. And I often tell the people over in Perth and in Armidale that sometimes you can imagine yourself like expanding or just rising up into the air or sinking into the ground. You're not doing that, it's just how it feels. And this one time, I imagined myself, I just in deep meditation, the body was expanding and expanding and expanding, and then somebody disturbed me. And I got stuck like that. That's why I look fat. I'm only making that one up, that's not true. But it's a nice excuse. Because sometimes when they get deep, sometimes some people think, oh, this is too much for me. So that's when I usually like cracking a joke. But the truth of the matter is that sometimes when the mindfulness gets strong, it can start playing around and have a lot of fun. Don't be afraid, it's good stuff.
All right, Ajahn, don't be afraid. That brings up another question that's come up, which is about loving kindness.
Oh, yeah.
And how can we practice it during COVID, particularly during COVID when a lot of people are having a lot of problems?
Yeah, it's like the same way as a Buddhist monk when I was in Thailand. We're supposed to have loving kindness to all beings, everyone. So what about like tigers? Tigers are dangerous. And I asked Ajahn Chah that and he said, tigers do not eat monks. That's what he said. And that didn't convince me at all. Because if a tiger did eat the monk, the monk wouldn't be left to tell us what happened, and a tiger wouldn't confess. So I don't know how many monks might have got eaten by tigers and no one knew. But I really liked the Chinese saying, love the tiger, but at a distance. So you can love people, you know, who are suffering from COVID, but at a distance to protect yourself so you can continue to help and look after people. But and everybody, you know, one of the things is if you see someone with COVID or you see a tiger, you know, you don't just see just the teeth of the tiger. That tiger's got a heart as well. And some of those animals are incredibly beautiful. And if you see someone who's sick with COVID, they're more than the sickness, there's a human being in there. And I always say that if you're the doctor, yeah, you have to talk about the sickness. But if you're a visitor, talk about the person. Everyone tells them they've got COVID, they've got to do this and got to do that, but it's more to them than that. So talk to the person and just a human being there, and they've got, send them a few jokes. In other words, talk to them as you would do if you were in a coffee shop together. And it's the same with like prisoners, some murderers, you know, which are in jail. Don't talk about their crime. Talk about who they are. They're much bigger than that, much more than that. And you see those beautiful parts in people, then you know how to practice loving kindness to someone who's psychotic. And they can never harm you. And in fact, they value you so much because at last somebody's seeing more in them than probably they can see in themselves. It's great going to hospitals and just, you don't go and ask, how are you feeling today? My stupidest question ever. They're feeling terrible, that's why they're in hospital. You just talk about something else.
Well, John, I have a question for you. I've spent a lot of time in Laos and in Thailand, and I was wondering if you'd like to share a memory of the villages,
yeah.
The local village with the temple with us. Just any memory that might come.
Yeah. No, there's sometimes that yesterday, was it yesterday? Yesterday, yeah. I went to one of the Thai restaurants to do the blessing. I had all these pictures over there of the old Thai villages and some of the old customs they have. And they're really beautiful. Number one, you don't see them crying when somebody dies. That was really weird. I never saw grief when I was in Thailand. Accepted, this is life. This is death. And so they carried on. Seeing that they're very, very poor. And you always knew when someone had got married, because when people give alms food to the monks and the alms round, you know, the young girls would always give alms food because make good karma, get a good marriage. And you'd always know who was just the most eligible in the family because they'd always have the nice clothes. And but as soon as the marriage was over, they passed the beautiful clothes to their younger sister, because they didn't need them anymore, they were married. And I felt, oh, that poor guy. You know, he looked at this beautiful girl and they were just about to get married, and they got married, and afterwards she was wearing rags the next day. I thought it was a bit funny, a bit unfair, but nevertheless. The nice thing about the village, when you were a monk, that you were part of the village. And that was really quite touching, because I remember just coming to Australia. And when I went back to Northeast Thailand after a month or two, after a few years over here, just went on the village for the alms round in the morning. And the women in the alms round, and the guys as well, they put little pieces of sticky rice in your bowl. And they look up and they start crying. You've come back to us. And it was just so emotional. You were part of the village. And these monks are just, like myself, gone over to Australia for a while, and you come back again. And they're just so happy to see you. And then, when I went the next time back to Australia, they all came to the airport to see me off. These were villagers, incredibly poor. By that time, we knew the owner of the Ubon airport. And of course, the owner of Ubon airport invited me into the VIP lounge. I said, I'm not going in unless these people come in as well. So all the villagers, really dirt poor, some without any sandals, all going into the first class lounge where all these businessmen had to keep out. And I kind of like that, a bit of a socialist rebel. But anyway, it's nice to see them come into the first class lounge for the first time and just seeing some of the new experiences for them. Very simple, but very loving.
Thank you, Ajahn. You've touched my heart.
Very good.
And reminded me of memories too. So thank you.
I can go on like that for a long time anyway. Ooh, memories in the past.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Lovely. Absolutely
yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. One last memory of Northeast Thai.
I think we have time for one last memory.
Okay. Yeah. That was a nice little memory of. the simplicity of that place where first year I was in Northeast Thailand, it was in 1974, I think, and you saw that I had to go in to do a little ceremony in the village. And one of the first times I went into the village at night time with all the other monks, as I walked in there, you see past every house it was built on stilts, the water buffalo were underneath. And above, and you can imagine the rooms around three sides of the house and an open area in front. In that open area, you could see the whole family, which was maybe about 17 or 18 people, grandparents, uncles, aunties, kids, some married, some not yet married, they'd all be sitting around this light. And the light was just a bowl of kerosene, and they'd put a rag through the top of a toothpaste tube, and that would float on the top of the kerosene, and then they would light the top of the lantern. I think it was kerosene, but they'd light the top. A very smoky light, but the light meant everyone could see one another, and the smoke kept the mosquitoes away. And they would sit around this light every evening, no TV, no radio, telling old stories, many of them exaggerated, many of them they'd heard before, but good old stories, every evening together, the whole family, and they were just so united. And when I thought of my childhood in front of a TV, we'd argue, two channels in the UK at the time, BBC and ITV, we'd argue what we wanted on. And we're missing out that warmth of a family which was so simple and so together. And that family life in those days, they're really, really poor. But I think what they had there with the love they shared between one another was worth much, much, much more than having money in the bank. They had the friendship and love and commitment together. And that was gorgeous. So if you lose a lot of funds and money, just all join together in a little house, share your lives together and have a lot of fun. Don't be afraid of telling stories, some true, some obviously lies, but have fun with them.
Oh, that's just a beautiful moment on which to, I think, wind things up for this evening, Ajahn. I'd like to thank you for helping us see the spaces, the silence and the beauty between things, and also for helping us find beauty in unexpected places.
Yeah.
So thank you very, very much, Ajahn. I'd just like to say thank you so much.
Bye, everybody. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Susu, I can see hiding. Yeah. Becky. Bye. Bye, Jay. Bye, everybody. See you.
Bye-bye,
Bye. Bye, Pinda. Bye. Yay.
Bye,
see ya.